It's the last day of the fiscal year, and it seems we may have a temporary fix to our state's budget problem. But it's still not a budget. So the question we're asking today, why haven't more people said enough is enough?
This is really completely decimating the system that we've built up over the years.
I'm surprised by the lack of response. I thought that more people would be upset.
Today, we speak with social psychologist Kirk Gray, who explains a little bit more about why people aren't so outraged. He'll be joined by the director of the Klein Center for Democracy, who will also talk about the best ways for citizens to get in touch with politicians. Also, Argonne National Laboratories in Lamont celebrates its 70th anniversary. We'll meet one of their newest researchers who studies our body's microbiomes. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Listening to the 21st. Welcome. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today's the one-year mark of Illinois operating without a state budget. We've all heard the words before to describe this situation. Social service groups and state university employees would say this has been painful. Those who advocate for cuts and say we have to find a balanced budget might use the term necessary. Regardless, it's unprecedented. We do know right now at this moment, House Democrats, the caucus that they were in this morning to figure out a temporary spending plan that's just broken up. We know that they're headed to the floor now, and they may soon vote to pass a six-month spending plan. That is not a full budget. Some have said lawmakers have finally caved because of pressure. One example of that, yesterday, many newspapers throughout the state carried front-page editorials with a one-word headline, enough. But many others have asked, why isn't there more outrage about this situation? No matter what side you fall on, it's clear we're in an untenable financial situation that ultimately, as taxpayers, we're all responsible for. That bill, by the way, is $8 billion. That's how far behind the state is on bills, the Chicago Sun-Times reported earlier this week. And here's another number they came up with, $9.6 million. That's how much as taxpayers we're having to pay in late fees and interest for failing to pay our bills on time. Money aside, there have been cuts, layoffs, and closures. Here are a few.
We've been offering a service for the past 11 months without the guarantee that we'll be paid for that service, and we'll continue to provide those services as long as we can, but certainly that time will run out soon as well.
We also had to close in April our Parents as Partners program that provided services for over 100 families, and now we're going to be losing services for an additional 43 families that we're serving.
If you combine mental health and substance abuse, you're looking at in excess of 550 people in our county that rely on our services. As of right now, unfortunately, we are slated to close our doors to clients in all of our programs on June 30 at the end of the fiscal year. DeWitt County Human Resource Center will close for client services.
This is really completely decimating the system that we've built up over the years.
I'm surprised by the lack of response. I thought that more people would be upset and marching, I don't know, protest letters. I'm not seeing as much of a response as I would have expected.
I think people are a little paralyzed thinking what can be done, and that can lead to inaction. But it just takes some small actions, however imperfect, to get the ball rolling.
Those were all people who have appeared on the 21st in the past few weeks to talk about how they've been impacted by the budget. You heard from Sharice Larson. She's a supervisor of the homeless youth program Project Oz in Bloomington. Vanessa Schwartz is a program supervisor with Metropolitan Family Services in Chicago. Lynn Scoville is the director of DeWitt County Human Resource Center. Julie Dworkin was the director of policy and with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. And we heard from two University of Illinois professors who penned a letter to the Sun-Times about the budget situation. It was an open letter to Governor Rauner that 264 university and community college professors signed, Dana Rabin and Kathy Prendergast. Dana and Kathy weren't the first to voice that frustration, and I should say that frustration isn't just directed at our Republican governor, but also our Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan. So that's why we started wondering about why we haven't seen Wisconsin-style protests in the state Capitol building. Those were thousands of people who took part in ongoing protests. We've seen that in other places like California when they didn't have a budget. We've been asking asking you on social media in the past 24 hours if you care or don't care why we have a budget. Ross and Gibson says, I do care. I want our legislators to care as well. You're hurting us while you get nothing done. Elaine in Chicago says, I care because people who most need services are being denied to them. What do you think? You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. As always, you can keep those tweets coming to 21st Show and those comments on Facebook. I've got two guests here with me to understand more about the caring part of this, the psychology of the situation. In studio with me, Scott Althaus is the director of the Klein Center for Democracy at the University of Illinois. Hi, Scott. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me, Nala.
On the line with us from North Carolina, Kirk Gray is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. Hi, Kurt. Welcome.
Hi there. How you doing?
Scott, I wonder if we could start with talking to you about why you think, certainly we saw those editorials, but maybe we haven't seen the level of care that lots of people think should be addressed to this situation. You think maybe part of this has to do with the media, how we're covering this.
Yeah, that's right. So for a typical media diet that somebody in the state of Illinois might have, you're going to hear a lot about national issues and some about international issues. You're going to hear a lot about local issues. But state-level issues are not local news for most localities around the state, and they're not of greater interest to the wider range of news audiences that are tuning in or reading the newspapers. It's the local newspapers that are going to have the most information about what's going on at the state. And one of the reasons why we're not seeing as much outrage is that over time we've had a decrease in the size of audiences who are paying attention to local news in the newspapers. That's one of the reasons.
That's one of the reasons. Kurt, you also think there are some interesting psychological explanations for why we maybe have a hard time wrapping our heads around having compassion for people in a situation like we're facing in Illinois. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. So I think research suggests that our capacity for compassion really evolved when we deal with one person or maybe two people who live close to us, live in our village. And the circumstance now with the budget is it's hurting thousands and thousands of people, mostly faceless people to many, who don't live right near them. And in that case, it's not only very easy to ignore the suffering of others impacted by the lack of the budget, but it's also, in some sense, paralyzing because the magnitude of suffering is so big. What can one single act do to help thousands of people? It's hard to wrap your head around that.
Right. And I think that the other part of it, and you and I were talking about this before we were on air, is that when we think about empathizing for someone, and we're thinking particularly as we're talking about different social service agencies, I wonder how much of it is you think that maybe we can't relate to a homeless youth or a heroin addict who might need help and think, well, they, you know, maybe because we can't relate to that situation, we can't really have as much compassion for them as we think we should.
I think that's true. I think, you know, part of empathy is really about putting yourself in the shoes of another person or really in the mind of the other person. And how we do that, psychologically speaking, is we kind of simulate what it's like to be that person, right? So if I'm trying to simulate what it's like to be someone who's had an injury or lost a loved one, then I can do that. But having never, you know, been addicted to heroin or been a homeless youth, it's very hard for me to simulate those people, and I think that's true of many. And if you can't place yourself in the minds of other people, it's hard to care about their plight.
Well, and also, Scott, I also think the reality of the situation is we haven't had a formal budget in place, but we have had agreements where about 90% of the money has been flowing through. So when we look at the population that's affected, it hasn't been the entire population.
No, it's been a very focused population, and it's been a population that is not politically visible. People who are receiving social services, who are getting help from the state in various ways, may not have the resources to mobilize themselves in order to effectively convey their concerns in a public way that other citizens of the state could see and act on.
But what about state university employees and students? Because that's been another huge impact of the budget. We've seen layoffs at different universities. We've heard students who haven't gotten funding, their MAP grant funding. You would think that would be a more visible portion of the population, right?
Well, certainly the higher administration officials in the university system have been very active in advocating on behalf of the university. But the ordinary employees within the universities right now, mostly aside from a hiring freeze, their situation has not changed dramatically, and we've been in a waiting mode for the past year to try to understand what will be the impact ultimately of these budget challenges on the university. We don't know yet, and that makes it difficult to know what, if anything, we need to do in order to raise more attention to the problem.
Yeah, we've been talking about why people care and don't care about the current budget situation we're in. And I should note that right now the House is voting on a temporary solution. We're going to have the results of that in a minute. In about 5 minutes or so, we're going to be joined by some reporters from Illinois Public Radio who are going to give us the latest on what's happening with this temporary spending plan that's being approved. Our phone number, if you want to join us right now, if you have questions or comments, as always, it's 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. Wendy from Urbana said on Facebook, "I care because this unconscionable lack of support for the most vulnerable in our society will take its toll for years. This impasse is pulling the rug out from under the institutions in our civic society that allow people to succeed and participate in our communities." Kurt, how much of this is also about, I think it's interesting when you look at the language of how politicians talk about this, you hear Republicans frame this as an issue of, we have to cut this because we don't have enough resources. We don't have enough money. And so cuts are important because we have to have a balanced budget and we don't have the money to pay for it. Democrats, conversely, say, no, we have to pay for these things. We're just not raising enough money and we should be creating more revenue. And I mean, not everyone, no one's saying we need to tax people more, but that's sort of the implicit understanding in all of that. Do you think, Kurt, the perception of scarcity also changes the way people approach this situation and how much they care about it?
Certainly. I think if social psychology tells us one thing, it's that our perceptions matter much more than reality. You can be a multimillionaire, in fact, and feel poor because, you know, the person living next to you has a much bigger boat or a much bigger house. And so certainly you are more, you know, justified in feeling like there's scarcity in today's, you know, global climate of unrest and uncertainty. But even if there's some capacity for real scarcity, I think our perceptions drive our behavior much more. And I think a lot of research suggests that people who are more conservative, more Republican, are generally more likely to see scarcity and threat in the world.
We're seeing lots of reporters on Twitter saying that the first piece of the budget package has passed the House. The vote looks like it's 104-6. We'll have more details on that in a few minutes. Just wanted to keep folks updated on that. Kurt, you have a really, as we're talking about scarcity, you have a really interesting description of this that you wrote about in your most recent book. It's called The Mind Club. And it's in this chapter called Enemies. And you talk about how competition for resources can turn people into groups that pit each other. And then you use an analogy in the animal world to kind of explain this. Can you share that with everybody?
Yeah, it's a fun analogy and an insight into human nature, I think. So chimpanzees and bonobos are different primate species, great apes, and they share the same evolutionary common ancestor. And both these species live in Africa, and they're divided by the Congo River. It's a very big river. It's very hard to cross. On one side of the river live gorillas. And gorillas and the common ancestor of chimps and bonobos, they eat the same food. And that means that there is a lot of scarcity for the same food. And the folks on the side with the gorillas, they evolved into chimpanzees. And chimpanzees are aggressive, very warlike, male-dominated society. They form, you could imagine, gangs, really, that are very tight and very violent. Although, you know, there's some room for compassion, but mostly fairly warlike. On the other side of the river, where there aren't gorillas, there's just a lot more food. And on that side, the common ancestor evolved into bonobos. And bonobos are a female-dominated society, and instead of violence, they spend most of their time having sex. They solve their disagreements with sex. When they don't have disagreements, they just have sex. You know, female-female, male-male, whatever, lots of sex. And I think the difference there between, in some sense, war and love depends on scarcity of resources. And with humans, it's not just actual scarcity, but perceived scarcity that in some sense turns us from bonobos into chimpanzees.
And so when you say perceived scarcity, what you're saying is it doesn't matter whether or not there's actual scarcity. It's just that if we think there is, that sort of affects how we deal with things.
Exactly.
One question I wanted to ask you about, we started this conversation, Kurt, you and I just talking about how this is such a big problem. It seems like there's a question for a lot of people, like, what can I really do as an individual citizen to help solve and help overcome a state budget impasse where lawmakers and our governor seem to be locked in this battle that has gone on now for an entire year. Do you think that what happens also, time, is that the link between what we would like to do and what we can do becomes a very difficult thing, even if it's something that is easily accomplishable?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly there's lots of places where our intentions don't match up with our behaviors. I mean, listeners can appreciate this if you want to lose a little weight for the summer or eat a little more healthily. We have a clear intention, and it's hard to get that translated into action. And in the case of eating healthier, the action we should take is actually pretty clear, right? Eat more vegetables, eat less ice cream. But in the case of helping pass a budget, those actions are very unclear. It's not clear to me at all what I should do to influence legislators. Writing a letter really do it, or holding a placard in front of where politicians work, would that do it? It's not clear, and I think that uncertainty impedes action in a large-scale way.
One thing you write about, we just have about a minute left. I don't know if you can answer this briefly. When you're in a competition for scarcity, how can you overcome that and break down these groups that we kind of divide into?
I think the best way, given by research, is to find an overarching goal. So in these classic social psych studies, you can divide people into two groups, make scarcity happen, and they're really nasty to each other. The way to bring them together is to find a common enemy. So Independence Day, that sequel just came out, right? How do you get humans to unite together? Well, you provide an alien threat to destroy us.
Okay. And unite against that. Thanks for
exactly.
That. Kurt Gray is the author most recently of The Mind Club. He teaches at the University of North Carolina. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation about the budget impasse and caring, and also add action into the conversation. You're welcome to join us. Tweet to 21st Show. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by the library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st on this last day of the fiscal year for the state of Illinois. And the question is whether or not we will have a budget, or at least a temporary fix, to help all of the people and agencies and officials who have had worked without funding for the past year. Let's go straight to Amanda Vinicky, who's on the floor of, or who's in the state house. I guess you're not on the floor of the house because they wouldn't let you have a phone, Amanda. But hey, she's our Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. Hey, Amanda, what's the latest?
Actually, we have had the House pass one part of this stopgap measure. It's something that's pretty technical. It's known as the BIMP. That's the Budget Implementation Bill. So it's something that is needed, but it is not the actual spending. They are really just getting things rolling. The major components of this package were voted out of a House committee bright and early this morning that had got things started at 8 a.m. Then you had legislators go into what we call caucus. That's basically private meetings where all of the Republican representatives get together and then all the Democratic representatives get together elsewhere and hash things out, go over things. And it appears that all went well. I heard from the House Minority Leader, Jim Durkin, that he has the vote. It's going to be four big votes. And as I said, really just getting underway.
Amanda, can you give us very briefly highlights of what this temporary fix will help people with?
It is really crucial to point out that it is temporary, that it is expected to be able to keep government operational through the end of the calendar year. And of course, that would also be through the elections. And then lawmakers and the governor would have to take yet another crack at it. And so when we talk stopgap, that's what we mean. It is money that would allow, for example, the Department of Corrections to pay utility bills or the Department of Veterans Affairs to be able to pay the water bill. Those sort of really basic elements that haven't been funded. It also gets some money to social services, and really many of these have gone the entire year, as we talked about many times on this program and elsewhere. They've gone a year without it. So this begins to get them some money. Also, universities, it finishes out that monetary award program. That's the low-income tuition assistance.
Those are the MAP grant funding.
Mm-hmm. The MAP grant funding. Mm-hmm. So that's for 2016, but not for this new calendar year. That said, universities do get money for 2017. So it's kind of confusing, perhaps, and there are different percentages of funding and different, whether it's for fiscal year 2016, which ends today, or fiscal year 2017, which starts tomorrow. The real point to get across is that it is finally getting the, you know, spigot opened and the money flowing.
That's Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky. Amanda, I will let you go. I know you've got lots to do. I know we can look forward to hearing your reporting later this afternoon and this evening, kind of breaking down and explaining everything as you have time to go through it. Thanks, Amanda.
Of course.
Our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We're talking about the budget. We're talking about what is a temporary spending plan that looks like it's on its way to being passed. We're asking people whether or not they care or they don't care. Mary says she's unhappy and angry. She's ready to vote out the governor and the General Assembly. She says voters will pay for their mismanagement through taxation due to all of the debt. Let's go to Damon in Charleston, who's on the line. Hey, Damon, welcome to the 21st. What's your comment?
Hi, thank you very much. I just wanted to add that not all the inaction might be paralysis. I think for some people like myself, you see, learn a little bit about Illinois politics, and you get so disgusted that you don't want to participate. It's almost like a decision not to participate. And then it comes to the question of what to do. Aside from voting in the general election, everybody out, without bias, every incumbent that can't work, I mean, just everybody. Not sure what we could do, because it seems like, again, Illinois politics is so corrupt and corrosive. It's hard to get a public referendum moving. The laws are strangely situated to protect speech during campaigns, so you can say things that aren't true. So just the whole process has become so painful, but I choose not to participate. So my answer would be vote every incumbent out, and then if that doesn't work, it seems like the only thing left is civil disobedience in the whole state not to pay taxes.
Thanks for that, Damon. But I think that, Scott, I wonder, Scott Althaus is with us. He's the director of the Klein Center for Democracy at the University of Illinois. I think Damon's opinions are probably pretty commonly held from a lot of people. I think Damon maybe summed up what a lot of the electorate is thinking and feeling right now.
Oh, yeah. And the problems affecting the state are very complicated. They're very nuanced. And the responsibility for them is very diffuse. We can't point to just one person and say that's the problem, although a lot of commentary wants to devolve the conflict to Governor Rauner against Speaker Madigan. It's far more complicated than that. And all of that works to hinder our ability to act on the frustration that we're feeling and knowing what we could do to accomplish something useful to help move this process forward.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what people can do, because mm-hmm. you have interesting insight on voting. And I think everyone tends to think, like Damon said, the voting is sort of what we can do. But there's actually a lot that citizens can do apart from voting.
That's right. And it starts with voting. Voting is an essential building block of democratic politics. The rules of the game say each person who is a citizen of a state or a country or locality has one vote to cast. And ultimately, that vote that gets cast is going to determine who the office holders are that are going to represent them on the issues that come before them at whatever level of government they're at. So voting is very important. But there's more that people can do beyond voting that can have an impact, but it may not be very obvious. So if we look at the kinds of activities that people could do, Those that communicate the intensity with which preferences are felt are very important. So writing a letter to a legislator or making a phone call to a public official and explaining in your own words why you're frustrated, asking for a solution, this is likely to have a much more greater resonance with the office holders than simply one vote cast among maybe a million. That is a way to communicate preferences and concerns in ways that legislators are going to be able to hear and really pay attention to.
That's Scott Althaus. He's the director of the Klein Center for Democracy. Kirk Gray's on the line with us as well. He's a social psychologist. He teaches psychology and neuroscience at the University of North Carolina. Kurt, as you were listening to Damon, I wonder what your thoughts were as you hear both what Damon said and Scott said about how to sort of maybe not be paralyzed, but turn that a little bit more into action. How important is it for people to have that pathway forward?
It's very important. So this has been studied, I think, mostly with health behavior, but it's certainly true with political behavior as well. You need, everyone has intentions, everyone has an outcome that they'd like to achieve, and you need a path forward, and it has to be kind of simple, achievable steps. And the first step especially has to be very easy and very simple.
That's Kurt Gray. He's the author of The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Kurt, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Scott, as you're hearing Kurt say it has to be simple, I mean, I guess that's maybe what people think, that they think are participating in the democratic process isn't simple. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's as simple as you make it, right? And so the more knowledge you have about how the system works and who the players are, the easier it is to figure out how you as an individual can make a difference. And we look back at the 2012 presidential election, and there's good political science data that inventories the ways that people have tried to express their preferences. Of course, a lot of people vote. 40% of people in 2012 tried to influence other people how to vote. 15% wore a button or put a sticker on their car to indicate their preferences publicly. 12% gave money to help a campaign, 6% attended a political meeting, 3% worked on behalf of a party or a candidate as a volunteer. And these are all ways that are they take some time, they take a little effort, but they aren't beyond the capacity of somebody who just wants to express their concerns in a focused way to do. And these individual acts can have ripple effects through the system that can amplify a person's voice much more than just casting that one vote in an election.
When we're talking about individual acts, I think there's an interesting distinction your research shows about a lot of people think I'm going to tweet at my lawmaker, I'm going to send an email. How important is that, and do lawmakers measure that versus, say, a phone call?
Right. So if you look at it from the standpoint of a legislative office and how they're hearing about what the concerns of their constituents are, there are lots of ways that those concerns come in. The more personalized those ways that those concerns are expressed, the more seriously they're taken. And tweets and emails and a wide range of electronic communication are not seen as costly from the individual perspective. It's easy to fire off an email and then forget about it. It's much more difficult to take time to write a letter, to talk about the issues, sign your name on it, and to communicate very clearly that this is my letter. This isn't just some form that I put my name into. I have communicated this. That sort of information gets tallied by legislative offices. Phone calls get tallied in terms of what side on the issue people are at. And these measures become very important indicators for legislators of what their constituents are thinking, because they don't have poll data. They don't have obvious means of assessing what is on people's minds, except maybe reading the local newspapers and seeing what the editorial pages have to say. So these ways that citizens make their views available easily and passionately to the office holders and their staff are really important for communicating what is on people's minds in a way that legislators can pay attention to.
Do you think that that's, and I think certainly at the national level, senators and representatives and governors are used to getting sort of a flood of those sorts of things. What about for your local lawmaker? And I'm also just thinking about the summer. This is a time traditionally when lawmakers are back in their home districts. If you were just a citizen and what would you say to a lawmaker if you encountered them in person, you think, to have sort of the most impact that would kind of register with them?
Well, that would depend on the issue that a person is concerned
about. So for this budget impasse?
Yeah. Well, it would be talking about how this issue matters to me personally or matters to my community, and expressing some knowledge of the impact of these things. One of the challenges is, as you've stated earlier, where the budget is pinching the most is in social services and higher education, a few categories that aren't very visible to ordinary people. How do I know that service by police or fire agencies have been degraded? Well, if I'm not calling them up to ask for a response, I'm not going to know. And that's the nature of some of these areas that are getting underfunded right now. We just can't see what the impact is now. It'll become more clear later on. So if I can express an awareness of what impact these cuts are having on my community right now, that is going to make an impact.
Here's what Kay said on Twitter when we asked if she cared or not. She said, I care because where I teach would close due to not receiving funds. So I think that's a very clear example of someone saying, look, this is a very clear impact to me. We also heard from people saying, look, the roads here are really bad. I care because I'm seeing how bad the roads are. People are saying different agencies that are closing. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Sure. And making your concerns known in a issue-specific way. The challenge is that the state legislature is not going to have as much power over your local road condition as some other things. And so there is a problem of matching up the issues that you're concerned about with the right level of government to address. And sometimes that can be a little confusing for people.
And what about if people who support what's going on? I mean, we've had callers to the 21st who say, look, I think Governor Rauner needs to hold firm on what he's doing. Would you say the same applies for people saying they want to? Is it often that you don't hear support for a lawmaker taking a position? You normally hear people who are more sort of against something.
Well, I think lawmakers deal with people that have concerns and complaints a lot. So it's much more likely that they're going to hear about those because they're trying to solve problems. But it certainly is important if you are supporting what lawmakers are doing in the budget matter or in any other issue for them to hear that support as well. The support and the opposition are both important sources of information because mostly people in public office, despite all the stereotypes, they really want to do well for their constituents. That's one of the reasons why they're there. And they can't do well if they can't get reelected. So they're concerned about what people think and how the concerns that their constituents raise might animate opposition to them at the next election. And that's the mechanism that a lot of political science research has identified, whereby citizens' own preferences get translated into political action by sitting office holders.
Kurt, one last question for you. We're hearing there's votes that are happening right now. It seems like these votes are going through the House. This is a temporary, as we heard Amanda Vinicky say a few minutes ago, this isn't a budget. This is something that will fix things through the end of the year. I've seen a couple headlines already from news organizations saying budget deal. Do you think that people will listen to this and think, oh, the problem's solved? And based on different media coverage they're hearing, think, I don't need to worry about this anymore? Do you think that would be a problem?
Oh, well, it could be, right? Because these issues are so complex and so nuanced that hearing there's been a solution is probably much more likely to register than, but we still don't have a budget. And in fact, the budget for the next fiscal year, which begins tomorrow, has not yet been a topic of consideration. It has not been talked about in Springfield. It has been 80 years since a state has gone as long as the state of Illinois without passing a budget. And we definitely have some problems. So if people are hearing, yeah, temporary spending passed, the situation is over, that is unfortunately going to perhaps reduce some of the pressure that might otherwise be placed on our lawmakers to really find a solution, not just a temporary fix, but a lasting solution to this problem.
Scott, final words of advice for people who are hearing this and thinking, like Damon, what can I do?
Well, be sure that you have preferences that are made known to your friends, to your family, to your office holders. It's easy to find the phone numbers and the addresses of your legislative representatives. And for them to know how concerned you are is one of the most important things you can do. There's one other thing that you can do, and that is this fall, depending on what happens, we may have the chance to vote on an independent map amendment. That would change the way that legislative districts are drawn in the state. And that would have an important long-term effect on getting us out of the problems that we're seeing right now, because so many of these legislative districts have been shaped to ensure stability for existing lawmakers.
Thanks to Scott Althaus. He's the director of the Klein Center for Democracy at the University of Illinois. Thanks to all who called and tweeted and posted on Facebook. You can keep the conversation going on social media. Stay tuned to the 21st. We'll have more updates on what's happening in Springfield in just a minute.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Lawmakers in Springfield are voting right now on a number of stopgap budget bills. The House has taken up a bill that would let the state take on teacher pension costs from the city of Chicago. It would cost around $200 million and stay in effect for 1 year. Earlier today, the House passed another measure to freeze cost of living raises for legislators, constitutional officers, and state's attorneys. Stay tuned throughout the rest of the program and for the afternoon. We'll have more on what's going on in Springfield. You know, it's probably appropriate, given our conversation today about the budget and the budget situation that we're in, to talk about a blooming flower that stinks. I'm not kidding. Last week on the program, we heard about the corpse flower. It's an unusual species known for its terrible odor and the Titan aurum in Charleston at Eastern University, Illinois' Toot Greenhouse. Here's greenhouse manager Stephen Mailhorn.
It is the largest flowering plant in the world. When it's in leaf, it puts up a single leaf at a time, which lasts for about a year and a half. And that leaf can be 20 feet tall by 15 feet wide. Well, the aroma is produced by a structure that's directly above the flowers. I would describe it as a roadkill in a dumpster.
Well, the corpse flower in all its roadkill dumpster glory bloomed last night. We were just able to speak with Stephen Mailhorn, the manager of the Toot Greenhouse, and he says the bloom is still open and it's even better than last night. He says it should still be photogenic, but not as smelly throughout the rest of the morning and into the afternoon today. It will probably gradually start to close up sometime this afternoon. Stephen says pictures just don't do it justice. It's much, much, much bigger and better in person. The greenhouse will be open until 6 o'clock tonight. If you can't make it to Charleston, the greenhouse is live streaming it. Obviously, there's no smell included in that. We'll tweet out the Ustream link, follow 21ST Show, and it'll be on our website as well. The Illinois laboratory that helped launch the nuclear age celebrates its 70th anniversary tomorrow. Argonne National Laboratory also led efforts to develop drugs to fight HIV, X-rays, solar roofing shingles, and many other scientific and medical discoveries. Argonne's located in suburban Chicago and Lamont, and its chief operating officer is on the line with us from there. Paul Kearns, welcome to the 21st and happy 70th birthday to Argonne.
Oh, thank you very much.
How are you all celebrating Argonne's 70th birthday?
Oh, there are a number of ways we're celebrating. We had an open house for the community where we had over 10,000 visitors come and enjoy the laboratory and the fantastic science we do here. We're having a birthday cake tomorrow for our laboratory employees with a nice celebration talking about our accomplishments. And we also have a social media campaign underway.
Are the 70 candles on the cake going to be specially scientific?
I think it'll just be a lot of fun.
Okay. What was the original mission of Argonne National Labs back in the mid-1940s, Paul?
Argonne was originally founded based upon the chain reaction experiment that Enrico Fermi did under Skaggs Field at the University of Chicago, part of the Manhattan Project, really focused on further development of nuclear physics as part of the peaceful use of nuclear energy, basically.
And why was it located just outside of Chicago? Was it because that was also kind of close to Fermi?
Exactly. Proximate to the University of Chicago and the great scientists and researchers there. University of Chicago continues to operate the laboratory today.
Paul, what were some of the firsts that have been accomplished at Argonne?
First, we talked a little bit about nuclear energy already, but realized that all the nuclear power plants around the world today are really based upon designs developed here at Argonne, and so that's very significant. We can talk about parallel computing and quantum computing as having some of the roots here at the laboratory. A lot of focus today on energy storage and really looking at some very practical uses in terms of the cell phones we carry, the grid storage, electrical grid storage of energy, and also thinking about the electric vehicles and really how we advance the utility, basically, of those technologies today by enhancing the storage life and the reliability of the batteries we have deployed today.
And how do you think the mission of Argonne has changed over the decades?
Oh, it's really been an interesting evolution, really fantastic to watch. Argonne's got great roots, if you will, in really nuclear physics and material science as a result of that as well, in terms of looking at those early discoveries of nuclear power. And really the evolution has continued from there, really building upon those very basic, if you will, foundational discovery sciences in many different areas. Today we do a lot of work, a lot of research, I should say, in areas like materials and chemistry, math and computer science, life sciences. We're very excited about our high-performance computing and leadership computing facilities we have here at Argonne. We have scientific user facilities like the Advanced Photon Source, which is really a stadium-sized X-ray microscope, which really allow people to understand what's occurring at the atomic level within materials and how they interact. We host over 5,000 users a year here at the laboratory to actually come and use the Advanced Photon Source. From around the world, they come to use our facilities. So.
That's
very exciting.
Yeah, that's Paul Kearns. He's the Chief Operations Officer, and I wanted to bring someone else into the conversation as we've been talking about how things have changed. Some of the recent research at Argonne involves microbiomes. That's the 100 trillion bacteria that live in and around our bodies. And I wanted to bring in a new research coordinator at Argonne, Jared Hampton Marcel. He just won a recent microbiome recent grant competition. He's also a PhD candidate at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Jared, thanks for joining us as well.
How are you?
Good. Can you tell me what you're researching and what you're trying to understand?
So basically, I'm trying to understand the relationship between bacteria in the gut and how they affect host processes such as like inflammation, immune, as well as metabolism.
What do we know about the microbial material in our gut?
We know a lot. So we know that they affect not only our digestion, but like how we break down macromolecules such as like protein, carbs, and we also know that they actually influence our inflammatory responses.
When you say inflammatory responses, what do you mean by that?
So I mean, environmental triggers, not being able to process foods.
Allergies?
Allergies, any type of immune dysregulation that you may have.
Okay. And I know that lots of you do work on the gut biome. In particular, you're studying athletes. Why are you doing that?
So basically, athletes represent a stable population. So we know that they have similar exercise regimens. They have similar diets. They also have similar kind of like inflammatory responses, as I was just talking about. So it kind of helps us understand the variability and being able to draw more direct conclusions about how the microbiome is actually affecting us.
Yeah, so they're kind of like a natural controlled group, it sounds like, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And you were an athlete, I understand?
Yeah, so played a little high school football, ended up walking on at the University of Illinois before being injured, but athletics has been pretty much a part of my life since I was a kid.
And has your research sort of changed your perception on how athletes should be functioning or what they should be eating?
A lot, yeah. So what's odd is I actually monitor my diet more now than I actually did when I was ever in college or during high school.
Can you explain a little bit about the bacteria and how it gets into our gut? Is it all through what we eat?
No, so it's not what we eat. There's developmental processes as well because we're actually born with bacteria. And the processes that we undergo during our developmental process, going from kids all the way to adults, actually help shape who we are and kind of how we respond to different environments. So it's coming from transmission from your mother. It's coming from environmental triggers that you are exposed to over your lifetime, as well as what you eat and well as different environmental situations.
And so in a way, do you think we have, I know other scientists at Argonne, like Jack Gilbert, I know you work with Jack, he describes it as a microbial fingerprint. Do you think that the way that all of these different trillions of microscopic bacteria, does everyone have different ones?
Definitely. So your microbial fingerprint is as unique as like your DNA. So not only can we identify you, but we can actually differentiate you and also have associative traits based on like your lifestyle. So being able to connect your microbiome to kind of how you actually function and some of your irregularities as well as some of the things that you're involved in.
Jared, this is a pretty new field. What motivated you to go into this?
Actually, it was Jack. Prior to this, my interest was in endocrinology as well as stem cells. And then I just took a position here at Argonne, and it just grew into an infatuation, a love that I just can't explain. And it's been something that's just driven me, because the more that I learn about bacteria and the more that I learn about how it affects host functions, the more I become interested in trying to tease apart those relationships and finding the causes and connections.
Jared, for all those athletes out there who are listening, what advice would you give them to help improve their gut microbiome, to improve their athletic performance?
So really monitor your diet. Also be aware of kind of some of your physical limitations, because your body is going to give off signs and signals that you're kind of pushing yourself a little bit too far. And don't get me wrong, all athletes are expected to push themselves, but sometimes you can do more damage than good.
And you mean you can do more damage than good to your body, to your gut bacteria, to everything?
your gut microbiome is going to influence your inflammation. They're going to influence your lactic acid production, so on and so forth. So the question is how do you remediate these effects and be able to stay in your prime and stay in your athletic peak longer? And that's what I'm trying to figure out through my research.
So you think even muscle soreness and muscle reactions, there's a relationship between that and our gut bacteria?
Yeah, so there is some literature out there that suggests that there is indirect evidence suggesting that when you're not using carbs as efficiently as you should, which is kind of like your main fuel source, that the body is basically going to compensate and utilize energy from your fat cells and your muscle cells in order to kind of meet those energy demands. So if you're doing that, you're actually taking away from the muscle output that it can actually do for its physical activity.
Jared, where are you at with your research? When will it be something where we'll be able to hear a little bit more about this and have advice that you're giving athletes beyond what you've already done?
I'm hoping within a year. I just started collecting the data. I have some preliminary data that I've been going through, and I've been finding some really interesting results. But it's really so much more so about not just finding the correlations, but finding an underlying mechanism that can really drive the further research after these projects.
That's Jared Hampton Marcel. He's a research coordinator at Argonne National Laboratory. I want to go back to Paul Kearns for just a minute, the chief operations officer. Paul, as we're hearing Jared talk about this research, I know, for example, the microbiome is sort of a cutting edge of science. How important is it for Argonne to be doing things now that are sort of pushing the limits or at the very outer edges of new scientific research that we're just starting to understand?
Yes, it's very important, very, very important. And Argonne's all about discovery science, really being at the leading edge of discovery and taking those ideas and really testing them and validating what we can, and certainly driving ahead in terms of what might be useful in terms of our everyday lives or potentially world-changing technologies. So it's very important for us.
Paul, you mentioned a social media campaign at the beginning to commemorate Argonne's 70th birthday. What are you asking people to do?
We're asking people to follow the stories, basically, and kind of discover the history of the great science and the research that's been done here at Argonne. Also asking them to discover, take a little time and get to know some of the staff and some of the employees here at the laboratory through that social media campaign, where we have folks really talking about their life here at Argonne, what they do on a daily basis, and the great science they do.
That's Paul Kearns. He's the Deputy Laboratory Director for Operations and Chief Operations Officer for Argonne National Laboratories, which celebrates its 70th birthday tomorrow. I want to thank Jared Hampton Marcel, who's a research coordinator at Argonne as well, for sharing a little bit about his new research into microbiomes, your gut bacteria, and in athletes. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
As I said, we've been watching several votes in the State House in Springfield this hour as we are the last day of the fiscal year for the state of Illinois. The House is taking up a series of bills related to stopgap budget negotiations that have been going on in recent days. So far, here's where we're at. The House has passed a bill that would let the state take on teacher pension costs from the city of Chicago. That's going to cost around $200 million and stay in effect for 1 year. Lawmakers in the House earlier passed a measure that would freeze the cost of living raises for legislators, for constitutional officers, and for state's attorneys. There's a couple more bills still to come that could provide funding for the next 6 months to colleges and universities, to social service agencies, and others. One proposal would fund K through 12 schools throughout the full budget year. Stay tuned to the station for more on today's votes and what the compromise might mean for local schools, groups, and agencies. And that's all the time we have for today on the 21st. Tomorrow, it's Friday, and our summer book series continues. We've compiled a list of books you're embarrassed to say you read. Let's call them our summer list of guilty pleasures. We're going to be doing that with the student chapter of the American Library Association at the University of Illinois. If you have suggestions for us to add to the list, you can email us at books@21stshow.org. That's books@21stshow.org. You can always find us on Facebook as well. Search for the 21st. All of the links for how to contact us or on our website. That's www.21stshow.org. We're produced today by Travis Stansel with production assistance from Howla Delahi and Ben Thomas Payne. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening and stay tuned throughout the day for more updates from Springfield.